Hi, and welcome to Power of 10, a podcast about design operating at many levels, from thoughtful detail to society and the world, and about interesting people and their personal journeys. My name is Andy Pollain. I'm a service design and innovation consultant, coach, trainer, and writer. My guest today is Ariba Jahan, a biomedical engineer turned innovation and product leader focused on creating social impact. She's currently the Director of Innovation at the Ad Council, where she established the organization's innovation practice. Ariba, welcome to Power of 10.
Hi, so excited to be here. Thank you so much, Andy, for having me here today with you.
So you've got this journey, this interesting background. I'm always fascinated by people who've started doing one thing and then kind of done a pivot, as they say, into design and innovation. So can you tell me a little bit about your journey from there to here?
Sure. It's interesting because, you know, back then when I was studying biomechanical engineering in undergrad, I think like education systems and career paths were very like one track only. And now everyone has so many different pivots and multi experiences. Yeah. So it's really inspiring to be able to see that. And I think it always helps me. So I grew up in New York City. I was born in Bangladesh, but grew up in New York City since I was 7 years old. And science and math were always my favorite subjects. So when it came time in junior high school, I wanted to start pursuing more specifically in the sciences. And so I went to Brooklyn Tech High School, majored in biomedical sciences. So I went to a high school that had majors. And from then, I got exposed to this space called biomechanics or like bioengineering. So I pursued that at Syracuse University, biomechanical engineering. And I think at that time, maybe by my second year, I was like, okay, I want to be a doctor. You know, I want to apply. I want to be in the room with the patients when they're making the decisions for adopting this new technology into their body. And that happened because, just backing up for a second, since my second year of high school, I always participated in like research projects and summer programs. So REU, it's a National Science Foundation program, but it's a program that's there to help high school students be exposed to PhD level research projects by working in labs. So I did that all sophomore to senior year in my high school. And I mean, that changed my life, being able to see like the science and application and seeing how research really fundamentally changes the things that are made and created. And I think in one of those lab projects where the project was all about a device that was there that was being created to help people with deafness, not in the mechanical sense, but like neurological sense, like the brain just doesn't connect the sounds. And I remember being in that lab and I was like, oh, I really want to help the patients make this decision. I'm sure you didn't need that whole long story, but it's in that moment that I pivoted from wanting to apply the science in the lab setting per se only versus like wanting to be in medical school. Then I went to medical school. I went to SUNY Upstate Medical University, which is also in Syracuse, New York. And I didn't enjoy it. I think okay. I thought it was going to be amazing. I thought I was going to be crushing it. You know, I was pretty much barely passing. And I'm glad I can laugh about this now because it was not funny back then. It was just earth-shattering for me. If you can imagine the journey you go on to even be pre-med, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So
pretty long, bro.
I think the biggest click for me, in hindsight, the click is definitely always hindsight. I'm not a memorizer. I'm much more of an engineer. That's why biomechanical engineering worked for me, and it was great. So I think second year or third year of medical school, I was like, okay, this is not working out so well. I don't know how many times I can give this a go. So I left Syracuse, I left medical school, and I came to New York. I was like, okay, let's figure this out. And at that point, I started getting on a lot of phone interviews with people to be like, so what else do people do? And I think I had to kind of go through my own journey with listening to advice. A lot of people said to go into teaching or go into biotechnology since I'm leaving medical school. But I kind of didn't want to be in a lab per se. I wanted to be I don't think I knew exactly what I wanted, but I knew I wanted to be in a space where I got to engage more with people. So I started working at a startup, which exposed me to what the hell a startup is, and understanding that there's business operations and product management and all those things. And then I got into product management. And product management is the bridge that brought me into Ad Council. So once I was doing product management, I wanted to use those skills for social impact. And that kind of became my transition into Ad Council. And then I think in my second year, Anastasia, who's my manager, her and I, she was already looking into, like, what does innovation look like at the Ad Council? And so her and I and many other senior team members, we worked on exploring that. And then we kind of created an experiment of creating my role.
Right. So, and you're still there.
Yeah.
So that's obviously worked. But sort of what, there's a seed in there, I think, of, well, at least it sounds like there was a seed in there of, you know, being interested about how the human experience of technology of some kind, I guess, and wanting to have some kind of sense of what's the human impact of this technology, whether that was in your kind of, you know, med school days or mechanical engineering days through to the work you're doing now. Is that true? There's a sort of desire to, is that where the sort of social impact thread runs through?
I never knew what social impact was, right? Like, I think social impact is more of a newer area of exploration, I think. Mm. And when I say newer, I mean, nowadays, I think you do learn a lot about sustainability and social responsibility in college. But like, when I was in college, I didn't really know about those things. Yeah. But to your point, I always cared about the impact of a thing that I'm making or a research that I'm doing on the larger scale, whether that's larger scale being like the human that is going to impact, larger scale being the system that is going to impact, and what other cogs are there. I think the first time I really saw how something you could be doing in a tool ends up impacting someone's life experience was I was doing a team project where we were designing or redesigning a device that's used to squeeze glue into lung tissue after the lung tissue has been severed for
that sounds horrible.
cardiothoracic surgery, right. You know, when someone has lung cancer and they have to cut away a bit of the lung tissue, they need to be able to use a seal to seal that tissue. And our team project was to redesign that sealant distribution device so that it's easier. So then what was interesting was, you know, we all sat down and we're like, oh, crap, we need to learn 3D modeling. Like, okay, cool, we'll learn that. We looked at, like, the patents, and we looked at all the research that informed it. And then I was like, you know, I think I'm going to go find out if I can go watch the cardiothoracic surgeon do this. And so she was like, yeah, come on. And what's great is she was pretty much as tall as me, which means we were tiny people. I'm 4'11 and a half, and I think she might have been the same. So what was interesting was like getting into the surgery, the OR, and then she needed to stand on like two boosters, two step stools stacked, and so did I. And then I noticed how, because she's shorter, her arm is shorter, so then her lever is different than someone who's taller. So, and she's doing the surgery for about 5-6 hours. So by the time she's applying the sealant, it's like the fifth hour in that surgery. So I think that was the first time where I took learnings from like being with her and then back to the design. And then, you know, I remember feeling like, oh, this is really interesting. Like in classrooms, you learn the things, but then being able to like witness her and then seeing how tired her arm got, or like how was the nurse in the surgery OR preparing the sealant and preparing the mechanisms. And I think that was the first time realizing like there is this holistic way of looking at this. And I think, look, there are people who do this for a living and they do this all the time. But that was I think that was the moment where I really realized it. And I think, you know, that part of my mindset has always been there. I just don't think I knew that was about user research or social impact. Yeah. And I think the social impact part came when I was working in the startup area. I wanted to work on products that had a larger impact in society. And I didn't really know where to find that. And then came across Ad Council as an organization, and I was really just surprised that that existed.
And so, you know, part of the social impact work that, you know, we talked about before we were recording was also around equity and inclusion. Mm-hmm. And in one of the things you said, which really stuck with me, was this idea of, you know, obviously since Black Lives Matter, which has been around for several years, but has had this kind of huge impact this year, and we're just recording at the end of 2020, is that there's a lot of kind of conversations about, you know, what we should be doing and doing in the future and so forth, but less conversation around, or less reflection on, what led us structurally to be at this moment where we actually needed to do something. So can you tell me a little about your thoughts on this and where you've been kind of working?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, even my own role in upholding white supremacy culture, right? I think for me, this year became about learning my own role in it too, and understanding, like, even if I'm a POC, I can still be upholding white supremacy culture and systemic racism. And I think a big part of it is a culture of assimilation, right? So I'm an immigrant. So I came here when I was 7 years old. And before I came here, you know, the American culture is glorified in Bangladesh. It's all about, like, you know, when we were immigrating here, everyone was just so happy for us and jealous of us. And there's a sense of already putting America and whiteness on the pedestal. So when you come here, or not you, I'll just speak from my own experience, because I don't think all immigrants necessarily have the same experience. Mm. I think immediately seeing so much diversity, and then honestly being treated differently since third grade, like, you just learn, oh, okay, I am different. You know, I remember one of the creative insult I used to get was, oh, you have HBO. And I was like, oh, no, we don't. We can't afford HBO. HBO stood for Hindu body odor. And so it was like my first exposure was that I can be treated differently just because of where I'm from.
Right.
And that was my first exposure to racism. And, you know, there's levels to that. That's just cruel and kids being kids.
Yeah, yeah.
And not being able to talk about it at home meant that I need to somehow process it all on my own and not really have context into what it is. And I think those are the types of moments that create survival mechanisms, or at least for me it did, where I was just like, okay, well, I can't change my skin color. What are all the other ways I can tuck myself away and hide? It's when I came to America, you know, going through the school health examination kind of system and process, that we discovered I'm half deaf. I say half because I have complete hearing loss in my right ear. Right. And the only health insurance we had was my dad's worker compensation. I think that's what it's called, which is really, really limited. Like, it, whatever is the state-of-the-art innovation is not what that's going to give.
Right.
So I think I was then getting mocked for my disability. And my teachers, you know, were very worried about my ambitions. You know, my guidance counselor in junior high school, when she learned that I wanted to go into one of the specialized science high schools in New York, she was very quick to say, you know, we should consider some sort of a vocational school or some sort of a specialized school for the deaf for you. And I was literally in front of her like, I can talk. I can hear you. I don't understand. You know, I'm learning sign language. I'll be fine. And then I ended up forging my mom's signature just to be able to take that specialized science high school test. And that was my decision, like, the night before of the test. So I didn't even get a chance to study. And, you know, when you immigrate here, you kind of just assume everyone else knows best. You assume the guidance counselor knows best. You assume your teachers know best. And my mom and my dad, you know, they were so busy with so many jobs that I really couldn't have that conversation with them. But I think it's those types of experiences that taught me you have to assimilate, or else someone is going to make assumptions about your capabilities and limit what you have access to. But I think that moment, I stopped wearing my hearing aids. I knew I couldn't change my skin color, and not that I ever should have. And in hindsight, how dare my guidance counselor tell me I can't pursue a career in STEM because of my hearing loss, right? Like, that feels insane.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I think those things taught me to assimilate. And now I think, you know, I'm sad to say that I have to do a lot of that unlearning. Because when I assimilate, I uphold racist cultures. I uphold systems designed against us, you know. And I think I'm trying to think about, even in DEI initiatives, how do we go beyond just like diversity? You know, it's sad to say DEI or world diversity has been a topic of extreme popularity for many years now, but there's still companies that haven't done diversity. They have a 5-year, 10-year strategy for diversity, and it's like, all you have to do is hire. There is no pipeline problem. The talent is out there. Why do you need a 10-year strategy for it? And then, you know, attrition happens, you know, so it's just like, oh, well, they come and they leave. And it's like, well, then have you created the conditions for diversity to actually thrive here? If your structural, if your organization, you know, each organization is an institution all by itself, where it has its own systems, it has its own structure, it has its own norms and culture. And all of those things have to be interrogated before you can just like bring a new pool of diversity, you know. And I think that's the part that I would love to see more work in. I know there are many people who are advancing that work. I just want to see it more.
So, I mean, the word initiative in itself sort of almost paints the problem, right? Which is that this is a new thing we're going to do. You know, it's an initiative, as you said, you know, that's going to roll out over several years,
right,
rather than a self-reflection and an unpacking of
how did we get
the situation we're currently. Yeah, how did we get here?
Like, what structure, you know, so you want to hire diversity. Okay, so why wasn't it already diverse? What are the things that got in the way?
Exactly.
Are those things still present? How are you planning to get rid of those things? And sometimes that means really interrogating the structures of the reward systems inside the organizations. How are promotions happening? How's hiring and recruiting happening? Who has the most power informally as well as formally? And I think those are the reasons a lot of times, you know, something becomes a huge priority. And then we have a whiplash effect where it's like, okay, great, now we got to move on to the next priority. What are the few initiatives that we could launch so that, you know, it hits a checklist. We can look back into 2020 and say, we've done the things. And, you know, I keep hearing different people say, well, it's a marathon, not a sprint. And some people saying it's a sprint, not a marathon. And I'm not so sure if it has to be one or the other. You know, I think it's looking at the long-term sustainability, not like, what is the 5-year plan that we're going to hit diversity? It's more like, how are we not only creating diversity, but what are the things we're planning to change in the organization so that diversity can be sustained over a long term and continuously thriving, right? That's two different things.
Yeah. Yeah. There's an expression that often comes up in design and innovation or in service design as well, in sort of, you know, co-design workshops and stuff, which is quick wins. But there's also another one about brilliant basics. And they often get conflated, you know, on one of those kind of 2x2 matrices of people are kind of mapping out stuff and go, well, those are the quick wins, you know, those are our brilliant basics. And I always kind of feel the need to say, no, brilliant basics are the underwiring, the kind of the basics are actually the foundational stuff. And those things are anything but quick to change. There are definitely things, I did write a thing about it's a marathon, not a sprint, but there's definitely things that you can immediately do and should do. But there are other things that are much more foundational and structural that take time, right? Because you're unpicking, it takes time to even work out what they are, let alone kind of then unpacking and changing a culture. And organizations in general, again, the word initiatives, you know, are terribly bad at stopping doing stuff. You know, really good at starting doing new things, but very bad at kind of stopping doing existing things and kind of letting things go. Apart from, you know, they might shut down a department and stuff. But in terms of kind of fundamental activities that are structurally part of the culture.
And I think one thing that really adds to that is the fact that these conversations happen separately. It's almost like, and it's happening separately in two different ways. One is, it's almost like the DEI conversation is happening in room B, but business conversations are happening in room A and C, you know, and it's like, why? Why is it being compartmentalized and separate? Because I think when it's like that, then you're not actually creating long-term structural changes. And it's okay if you don't have answers, but it's, you know, I think some initiatives are okay. Like one example would be if an initiative is to launch an ERG in your organization, amazing. Make sure then you think about or do a little digging around what resources and support and conditions are needed for that ERG to survive and thrive. So that's an initiative, great. But then what is the long-term and holistic change that you're trying to create in the organization, which the ERG is part of that, right? Like if you're not sustaining diversity, then you're going to end up with an ERG that has zero members. So what was the point, you know? And I think because the conversations are happening separately where we're going to have this group of people focus on DEI, and that relieves the burden of DEI prioritization off of everyone else. So it automatically sends a cue through the organization that DEI is important, but it's only important for only a group of people to think about. And if they're not also the same people that have decision-making power within the organization, then is it really going to create change? Or like, what is, you're kind of creating the constraints of the impact it can have just by architecting it in that way. And I think the other distinction or the other separate conversations I'm seeing is like, we're not all in the same room. We're not all like cross-functionally having that dialogue in the industry where is there a marketing take on DEI as how they're thinking about translating messages to their audience versus like, how does it play a role in product design? How does it play a role in policy design? How does it play a role in the onboarding of into your product or where you think your product will thrive? You know, like it sometimes feels like every function is left to their own devices to interpret what DEI really means for them and then to create priority decisions based on that versus I do wonder how incredible it could be if we're all doing it together. And there might be organizations that are already doing it, and I'd love to know who they are because I think there's a lot to learn there.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of parallels. We talked about this before as well between that and sustainability, in that the kind of joined up conversation is exactly what you need to make any impact there, because you can't be having an organization saying, well, we really kind of care about, you know, our contributions to climate change or being more sustainable, and at the same time, our primary KPI is growth that uses resources and all the rest of it.
Right. Right?
You can't, you know, and again, it's the same thing, which is not what should we be doing, it's more what should we stop doing, but also how do we get here in the first place? And out of those things, what do we need to fundamentally change and stop doing? Otherwise, regardless of what we do, there's this, I mean, you said it sort of before, there's this like, it'll start and then you get the kind of the initial surge, but the momentum of that other bigger thing is just going to gradually kind of push it down to zero again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I really like that you said, what should we stop doing? I know teams probably have that as part of like their retro questions or like their stand-up questions of like thinking about what do they need to stop doing? But I'm unclear on whether that question is being interrogated on a organization level.
No, I don't think so.
I think the other thing I think about is like, values, right? Every organization has their own like pillars of capabilities as well as the values. And I always wonder, like, is there a way to formulate those values where it's like, what does it mean to be doing our work in those values? And what does it mean when we are actually doing things that's against those values?
Yeah, absolutely.
And values is like not an easy, but I'm sure it's actually really hard to put those things into writing. But in terms of DEI, like if organizations create their own goals and value systems around those, I would love to see like, what are the things we're doing that actually hinders our DEI?
Yeah.
So to your point about this bloating of work volume that ends up happening when there's like new priorities that's created on top of existing work, you know, there needs to be a little bit of a pause to be like, what are we doing right now that's actually not in service to this DEI future that we want to see?
Yeah.
There's an amazing diagram, and I'm blanking on the person who created it. I stumbled upon it you know, there's been so much sharing of anti-racism resources. It's a great diagram that shows, like, what's the phases of anti-racism, what's the phases you'll go through to becoming an anti-racist organization. And I think it had, like, 7 phases. And I loved how it captured the nuances of, like, you may end up in phase 3, which looks like you're saying all the right things, you have initiatives, but blankly put, it's just performative. And then, you know, phase 7 is like, okay, your anti-racism goals and pillars are really threaded throughout the whole ethos. Like, it goes deep into the structural basics of the organization. And I don't know if everyone is sitting down and saying, like, okay, let's be real. Where are we in these phases? You know, and what's causing us to be at this level? And what are the things we would have to interrogate and address in order to even get to level 7?
Absolutely. So the other thing, you know, talking about this year that we've been kind of chatted about a little bit before is, yeah, this year, 2020, the kind of year that's going to go down in history as a tough one for a lot of people. And I'm kind of feeling very depleted as well. You know, which is how you're dealing with kind of how teams are feeling, how they're kind of their resilience through the pandemic and their resilience for themselves and not just kind of showing up at any cost. And how have you been kind of working with teams that way or talking with them about it?
I think for our organization, you know, we're based in New York and we are in person first and some people were remote, and then just like everyone else, it just suddenly became, okay, we are remote until further notice. And there was no onboarding. And I think many of us started, and we didn't have like existing working norms that are designed around remote working. So I think there came a point where what I call pandemic productivity, which is like all of us working endlessly because work and personal life boundaries disappeared. And we also were trying to figure out, like, how do I make sure people know that I'm doing work, you know? So overcompensating and responding to every darn thing that comes your way, whether it's email, Slack, text message. And around, I don't even remember what month it was, to be honest. I think it was May or June where I knew that I was about to lead a team on a project and I was very mindful. I already knew that we had a high work volume at work, but I also knew at that point that we were hitting emotional burnout. So for me, that's when I started interrogating the difference between survival and resilience. And I think survival is, like, to your point, is just showing up at any cost, you know, and often that cost is yourself. And then resilience is like, okay, how do I keep myself at least at 70% battery and not lose myself to the red at the end of this project? And the thing is, when the pandemic hit, it interrupted all of us, whether you were already in survival mode or resilient mode before that. But like, if you were in a little bit of a resilient space, then at least you have a little bit of battery charge in you to come back. And I think keeping that in mind, I started thinking about, like, how do I create feedback loops with my team so that I know where they are? Because I barely know where I am day to day. You know, so we did rituals like check-ins and check-outs where I would just ask, like, what's in your headspace? What's in your heart space? Any surprises? And I think rituals like that normalize pausing and normalize talking about what's going on and naming the things that's happening that could be literally getting in the way of you showing up. And then actually using that information too. There's been times where I shifted timelines because I was like, okay, after a check-in, the team seemed like they are not in a headspace to do more user interviews.
Right.
You know, and so we shifted it. And I think that's the part of it that mattered the most. Is step one is to just like, how do I even create the space for people to be honest about what's in their headspace and heart space? And part of that means, like, for me to be really honest about how hard it is for me. And then the second part is, once they're actually being that honest, is honoring what they're sharing and seeing what decisions can we change. I mean, what decisions can we make? What changes can we do so that this is feasible? How do we maintain some feasible progress, but not at the cost of ourselves? I think rituals like that really helped establish trust in our teams. One thing I ended up learning was like, we were suddenly so video on that one of my colleagues was like, hey, when we're just doing our own internal meetings, can we be video off? I would love to take a break from permanently smiling so that when we're on the user interviews, I can kind of bring my full like engaged self. And that was hugely critical, right? Because we were doing a project on unemployment benefit access, and here's these individuals who are navigating the unemployment experience and giving us the gift of their time. So how do we honor that time? And, you know, if that means video off it is before that meeting. If that means having a day of not being on interviews to take a break so that we're better listeners, that's what we'll do. So I think like I learned a lot from my team. I think sometimes there were moments where I was like, I don't know what things I need to change. I don't really know. Like I'm supposed to have answers. And then I realized I can't have the answers, but I think I have to ask often enough or ask one-on-one and just be very open to hearing what needs they have, even if the need changes week to week, because it just all felt very unpredictable.
Yeah, it's true. It's quite, I don't know about performative. Maybe it is performative, but it's certainly quite, because the window, literally like the actual kind of physical window, but also of communication is just around the head. And, you know, you can't just be in the sort of same space next to someone and they know that you're listening. And there is a certain amount of performative listening, isn't there, that happens over video. And I think it's like you're kind of on stage. Mm-hmm. I think even just a lot of the kind of way of thinking is like, oh, the video's on, like the camera, lights, action, you know. It also feels like the metaphor around that or the mental model of it is now I'm kind of performing in video.
Right. Like I have a ring light on right now. I never needed to own one before, right? There's you can hire Zoom stylists who will give you a strategy on how your Zoom window needs to be, like what needs to be in the view. I think one of the things that honestly made me panic when all of this started is I have a really hard time note-taking and processing audio at the same time.
Right.
And when we went all virtual, you know, I was like, oh, snap, like how am I going to do this? Like there's going to be a lot of meetings where I may not catch everything. And you know, going back to my own accessibility needs, I've never prioritized my own accessibility needs until 2019, where I had, thanks to a lot of therapy, I finally said, I'm going to buy hearing aids again so I could hear better, so I could process a little better. And then when we came into this remote world, you know, I can't have a headset on and my hearing aids on at the same time. There's only so much space in my ear canal. So that was really, really scary for me. And one of the first things I shared with my team was, hey, like when we were identifying like what roles we wanted to play, in what moments, like in user interviews and annotating or like, you know, for the most part, we did all the things together. And I really wanted that. We were a cross-functional team. So I had someone from PR and I had someone from strategy and I was like me. And we did all the things together, from researching, from like generating insights, coming up with ideas, doing mock-ups. There was no like, well, you're this, so you can only do this. And I think that allowed us to really flex new learning muscles and all the things. But there was a moment where I asked like, hey, like, I know you're from PR. I know you're from strategy. Like, are there skills you're trying to build that may not be within those areas already? So we could like create the space for all of us to grow. And then we also talked about what needs we had and what work styles we had. And the first thing I had to share was like, so I am not good at taking notes while listening or like while I have to participate in a dialogue. It's really hard for me. And then one of my coworkers was like, great, because I don't want to do any of the interviews. I will note take for you if you can take the lead on interviewing. You know, so I think like even having that level of honesty allowed us to know like, oh, like I wasn't expecting that from her. I thought she would want to do a lot of the interviews. But then I was like, okay, great, because I'm very comfortable asking questions and facilitating these conversations. But I remember how like scary it was for me to say that because of my lived experiences where just because of my disability, it felt like I was being labeled as less capable, you know? So I think it's easy to operate from like, okay, I want to show you that I can do everything. But I think me admitting to my own accessibility needs helped like set the norm. Like we all have different needs.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, you mentioned also doing sort of co-design and co-creation rather over Zoom, and particularly on the unemployment benefits project, and the need to really be reflexive and consider kind of the your own positions of privilege or also of other people's vulnerability.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we're three people with full-time jobs having the privilege to learn about unemployment and not having to actually navigate it, right? I think for me, I spent, I don't even remember how many years, but we were on food stamps. And I know we spent many years not being able to even have health insurance back then. I knew that...
This is when your family first came to America.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, yeah. Sorry, I realized I like, in my head, I jumped back to when I was seven, but I didn't actually say that.
Yeah, it happens to lots of people all the time without them realizing it.
Touché. So I knew that there was variety of experiences, and I knew that just because I had that lived experience doesn't mean that that's everyone's lived experience. But I knew that from knowing that I had that experience, I think all it did for me was made me mentally be aware of the privilege that we have. And I think I was really lucky. My teammates are very aware too, and I think all three of us were able to think about like, hey, how do we make sure we honor their time? How do we ask questions where we're not coming to the conversation assuming we know the answers or like we have the best design or we have the best solution? It's more about like actually the opposite, that because we don't have their experience, because there's a limitation of how much you can empathize, like we're gonna do this wrong. And it's the people who are actually experiencing having to navigate the benefit system that have the answers, or maybe they don't have the answers, but we're not here to validate or invalidate their lived experiences, but we need to create the space to make sure that we are listening and never making the assumptions that like, well, if we ask 20 questions, then we'll empathize enough. You know, I think what was really critical for us is remembering like an interview is not going to suddenly give you the complete snapshot of someone else's life.
Yeah.
During that time, they're sharing with you what they feel comfortable, what feels necessary to share, to answer the questions that you're asking. And that is all, you know, and I think it's a little silly to assume that it's beyond, it's more than that. And, you know, you and I are having this conversation. So whoever is going to listen is going to know only this part of me, you know, from this interview. That doesn't mean you know everything else.
Yeah.
And I think that's why I have struggled with the word empathy, and I know there are many people that I respect and I learn from that have done a great job communicating that there's limitations to empathy, right? Tatiana Mack is a great example. She's done a lot of talks where she emphasizes that. And I think the first time I heard one of her talks was like, it just clicked for me, and because I never really understood that word. And what I mean by that word is like, I understand the definition of it, but I never understood the amount of weight that is put on it. It's treated like a responsibility, but it's also treated like a do-goodism. Like I can empathize and I am so skilled at empathizing. And it's like, no, you're great at asking questions and getting information, but you still have your own privilege and lens, and that is different. And I think it's critical to not see that as if it's a barrier, but like see that as like that is just real. I have my own biases. I have my own lens. I have my own lived experiences, and I can't undo them and suddenly empathize so much with someone that I just get them. And I think it's not silly, but like maybe also really entitled to assume that, you know, I'm half deaf, but that doesn't mean I can fully understand the lived reality of someone else that's also deaf or someone else who has full hearing loss, you know?
Yeah. It's a fantastic example of how looping all the way back to the beginning of how having a diverse team in the first place helps you even just surface all of those questions or be aware that those are even questions you should be asking or conversations should be having with each other, not necessarily to kind of fix it and have the perfect response or know exactly what to do, but to know this is stuff that's in the room. This is things we need to think about. And without that diversity of people in that team, and I mean diversity in every sense of, you know, race, gender, sexual orientation, class, you know, all the rest of it, and as well as the sort of cross-functional within an organization.
Yeah.
If you don't have that, you don't get that. You don't have the conversation, right? It's just full of assumptions.
Right. And I think on top of that is like, how do you create the diversity so that there's the dialogue, but not doing it in a way where you're relying on that one person to represent that whole community? So like making sure that you're not like, okay, great, we've got someone that represents all of these differences that we know we need to have. And now that person is going to be the representative of all the things, right? Like, I'm not going to be the representative of all POCs or all women of color or all women or any like variations of that. And we shouldn't look for that. Yeah. I think sometimes it's treated as, okay, great, we've got an Asian person in the room. Great. So can you give feedback on this Asian targeting project? You know, my skill set is my skill set. My lived experience is not the skill set that I'm selling, right? So it's diversity is, I guess what I'm saying is there's a really fine line between where diversity, looking for diversity can become tokenism. And I think that is what you can have when you have diversity, but not equity and inclusion. You know, that is a side effect of that, where you're not being mindful of, am I really expecting this one Black person on my team to be the spokesperson for the entire Black community? Or am I expecting this one person who uses a certain assistive technology to become the spokesperson for all people with disabilities? You know, I think that goes back to the interrogation of process, structure, and culture, right?
Yeah. And so, you know, will that one person do all of this so that we don't have to?
Right. Exactly.
Right, is the kind of other part of that. And it, again, come back to the sustainability comparison there, which is, you know, other people should be doing stuff so that I don't have to change my lifestyle. You know, that's it happens all the time. Listen, we're coming up to time. The Power of 10 is named after a Rand Charles Eames film that's about the relative size of things in the universe. And the final question is always, what one small thing that's either overlooked or should be redesigned has, or would have, if it got redesigned, an outsized effect on the world?
I think, you know, it is December. Everyone might be in a very burnt out but reflective headspace. So I think maybe having a reflection on what is the power that you have. And it's not like just because you have power, you have to like dissolve yourself and disappear and vanish and be invisible. But how do you use your power to create more equity around you in the products that are designed, in who you're reaching and who you're excluding? What's the power you have to help inform decisions that could actually benefit from having some serious interrogation? You know, how are decisions being made? Are you part of decision making that you actually think that there are other people that should be part of making that decision? And could you create space for that? You know, I think I think we talked a lot about power this year. And I think it's, sure, acknowledge and be aware of the power that you have, and then maybe wrangle that power and think about how do you create changes in the structures that you are part of. And that structure doesn't have to be some major organizational structure. You know, if you want to at least break it down to like, if you're a team leader, how are meetings running? Who's creating the tone? Who's setting the agenda? I think even something as simple as setting the agenda has power, because you're creating prioritization and norms and what's acceptable behaviors and non-acceptable behaviors. So I guess what I'm saying is reflect on what power you have in all the different spaces you exist. And how do you use that so that you're learning too, and how those powers could be used and misused? And if you're kind of in your own DEI journey, or if you're in your own, not if, we all are, but like if you're kind of thinking through, how do I create more equity in the work that I do and the way that I lead, maybe reflect on how we got here for yourself, you know, and the organization you're in or the organization you lead, and thinking about which one of those can you work to shift in the new year.
That seems like a very powerful reflection to end on. So where can people find you online?
You can find me on Twitter. It's just my first and last name. So that's Reba Jahan. And I'm on Instagram as well. Same name, Reba Jahan. And my website is RebaJahan.com.
And on LinkedIn too, right?
Oh, yes. LinkedIn too. That's right.
We'll put all the links in the show notes. Thank you so much for sharing all those experiences and insights and being my guest on Power of 10.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm really excited that we got to do this together. Really appreciated this time, this conversation, Andy.
Thank you. As I'm sure you're aware, you've been listening to Power of 10. My name is Andy Pullane. You can find me at apullane on Twitter or pullane.com, where you can find more episodes and sign up for my newsletter, Doctor's Note. If you like the show, please take a moment to give it a rating on iTunes. It really helps others find us. And as always, get in touch if you have any comments, feedback, or suggestions for guests. All the links are in the show notes. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.